Yeah, I'm a little bit different to the other speakers. Just because these guys are going to give you very slick marketing sales pitches, because that's what they do. That's not my background. I'm not really a marketeer or a salesperson. But I'll do my best to muddle through. And this is a little bit back to the future for me. My very first presentation when I joined ALPSP was actually to an ICOLC meeting, one of the European ICOLC meetings, talking about some consortia stuff. And this will actually be the very last talk that I'll give with an ALPSP hat on, because I'm about to leave and join Oxford University Press. But that is my job title for the moment, and that is my email address. Okay, I just wanted to spend a couple of minutes just talking about what ALPSP is, for those of you that don't know, because it's relevant to what I'll go on and talk about. You may well know that we are the International Association for All Society and Mission-Driven Publishers, and that includes all sorts of organizations from learned societies, charities. We have quite a large cohort of IGO and NGO bodies like the World Bank and the OECD. It's a real mixed bunch. And in fact, all other members of the scholarly publishing chain can also be members as associate members, so that includes the commercial publishers, vendors, even libraries. And we've been around for almost 40 years, founded in the UK in 1972, and we're actually the largest association for scholarly publishers in the world, with something over 360 members, and members in 40 countries. And I think this is relevant to today's discussion, because I just wanted to remind us all about the landscape of scholarly publishing. These statistics are drawn from a paper by Rain Crow, which I encourage you to read. It does have these stats in there, but it's actually a very interesting paper in its own right. It's published in First Monday. And some of the work that that Rain reports there is about the landscape. And quite a startling statistic, that 97% of society publishers publish three or fewer journals, and almost 90% publishing just one, which, when you think about it, is quite astounding. Could you put your hand up if you work for a publisher that's in that category? A few of you. The issue, of course, is that a lot of those smaller publishers don't actually interact all that much with the rest of the community. And whilst they're individually, they're small, collectively, you know, it's obviously a very important group of publishers. There are around about 10,000 societies, we think, that own at least one journal. So, you know, 9,000 societies that publish one journal, that's pretty serious. It, of course, complicates the value chain, complicates the whole interaction between libraries and publishers. And collectively, they own around just over half of the world's journals, and about two-thirds of those are self-published. So commercial publishers play a role in just under two-thirds. So that causes some problems, as I suspect many of you will know. It's difficult for small publishers to be seen in the marketplace, and crucially, they're not, generally not big enough to support an international sales force. Of course, some publishers may only publish one journal, but it'll be a huge thing, British Medical Journal or something like that. So those guys, of course, will have their own sales forces. But a lot of the journals are very small. The societies publishing them don't have the resources to send out international sales forces polishing doorknobs and selling their wares for them. And as we all know, the world has got much more complicated in the electronic era. When you used to sell somebody a journal or a book in print form, you didn't have an 8-page licensing agreement to negotiate, but of course that's different these days. And penetration of the consortium market has been incredibly difficult for those small players, because they're just not big enough for the consortia to really interact with in any meaningful way. Obviously, the consortia picking off the larger publishers and the larger journals. So it's difficult and complex and time-consuming for everybody. And there's a further problem for small publishers in that, as we all know, a sizable proportion of academic library budgets are tied up in big deals. And the more of that budget that's tied up in big deals, the less there is for single subscription purchases for that, again, come back to that very long tail. Smaller publishers, as I say there, they, of course, don't have enough content to bundle journals themselves. And that raises the question, well, that means that the smaller publishers maybe are losing out. So ALPSP, as a trade association that looks after those smaller publishers, should we oppose big deals? Well, of course not, because despite the bad press that the big deals sometimes get on library listservs, they're popular. We did some research a couple of years ago looking into library purchasing habits, and the number of big deals that libraries are purchasing is going up, not down. So whatever you think about them, they're popular with libraries and librarians in particular. So rather than opposing big deals, we wanted to create something which allowed our members to participate in something like a big deal, and that was the ALPSP Learned Journals Collection, or the ALJC as we call it, which we partner with SWETS. And there were some initial challenges for ALPSP. Finding the right partner was, of course, extremely important for us. Engaging with our publishing communities. ALPSP is a small organization. We don't have enormous resources in terms of people or money. And, you know, we had a lot of things that we needed to tick off in terms of generating interest among our community to begin with, given that it was, you know, an unknown quantity. But all these things, determining contracts, revenue share models, governance, how the thing generally would work. And because I work for the sort of organization that I do, I report into a council, and those governance structures tend to be concerned about reputational risk, so a lot of headaches with that sort of stuff too. Operationally, and I think this is the real crux of what I want, if, you know, this is the takeaway message, we're a consortia of publishers dealing with consortia of libraries, and that makes life extremely complicated. You won't be able to see this at the back, I wouldn't have thought, but you can see there's a many-to-many relationship in terms of the publishers and the libraries and the consortia, and in the middle, there's basically the ALJC process, which is basically administered on our behalf by SWETS. But it's. I just put that slide up to show that it's a complicated story. Agreeing anything that's not standard is not trivial, because there are lots of different people, different players involved. They have different attitudes, different views on everything you can possibly think of. And the market has changed. Actually, it's changed a lot since we launched the collection. And, you know, I have to put my hand up and say that there were some issues that we just failed to address adequately when we started this thing off. I've mentioned a couple of them there, post-cancellation access and digital preservation solutions. The publishers that are involved in the collection actually have a contract direct with SWETS. They don't actually have any kind of legal arrangement with ALPSP, other than they have to be ALPSP members. But it's then been very difficult to go back to those people who were originally involved and saying, well, look, you know, you really need to have some kind of digital preservation solution in place, or, you know, you need to do this about the your post-cancellation access. So as I say, it's the ALJC itself is a collection of online journals. You have to be an ALPSP member in order to participate in the collection. That's basically the only rule. And it's sold by SWETS, both as a single package and in subject collections. We responded to some market feedback that libraries said they wanted smaller subject collections, more targeted subject collections, and then they haven't bought them. They all buy the full collection, as it turns out. No surprise. And it's done under a single umbrella license, usually for 3 years. That was the original intention, but actually we vary that as it turns out, the access is from a single platform, from the SWETSWISE online content. Although actually, I think I'm right in saying that you can also access the content direct on the publisher's platform as well. We hope that the quality is high content. Certainly, that's the feedback that that Sweats get, and obviously we would hope that our members are publishing good stuff. And we also give back file access back from 1997. And there are things like fixed price increases and the pricing based on historic print spend. And I'll come on to this in just a second, but that's increasingly a headache. But it has been pretty successful. It has definitely allowed access to consortia for those smaller publishers. The fact that we partner with Sweats means that they have access to local language sales support, for instance, which otherwise they wouldn't be able to easily leverage. And there's no doubt that it's generated additional revenue for publishers. But many of the publishers involved in the collection actually are doing it more for the visibility in markets that they otherwise wouldn't be able to get to. And we get a lot of feedback that, you know, yeah, sure, they're happy to, that a check drops through the post every, drops through the mail every now and then. There can be other reasons, and certainly, visibility for their authorship in markets they wouldn't otherwise be able to reach has been a big determinant for some of them. And as I say, actually, the partnership with Sweats has been crucial. They have been a very good partner for us on this particular project. They've taken it very seriously from day one, putting dedicated sales resource behind it, putting a lot of effort into engineering the back office systems to try and simplify that complicated picture that I showed you. As I say, I think it's been a positive relationship both for Sweats and for our member publishers that are participating. For the libraries, there are obvious advantages of a standardised pricing model. The contract negotiation is both simplified, and of course you're just dealing with one contract instead of we have 50 or 60 publishers involved in the collection, so it's one contract instead of 50 or 60, and we're able to coordinate service level agreements and those sorts of things. So this slide just shows the growth of the collection since 2004. You can see in 2004 we had 247 titles in the collection and 25 participating publishers. In the intervening years, the number of publishers has doubled to 50, and we now have over 1,000 titles in the collection. And fortunately, the sales have grown as well. These aren't real numbers. This is just indexed to the 2004 figure, but you can see that pretty dramatic growth in sales there. But we have become a victim of our own success. The collection is growing, and so it's becoming more expensive overall. It's still inexpensive on a title-by-title basis. But also the returns to individual publishers. If you have a small journal, but basically the revenue share is based on the full rate subscription price, a discounted version of the full rate subscription price for your title. And so if you have just one journal, the actual financial returns to publishers it can be modest, but as I say, that isn't always their motivation for participating. We're looking at updating the pricing model and the license. As I say, there were certain things that we didn't really take care of adequately at the beginning, so we're looking at that. And I come back to this point about about pricing based on previous print spend. Obviously, the further you go into that, the less sense it makes. And it also is not terribly good for any new launches. And many of the participating publishers are still launching titles, and that's it's a particular challenge for them getting those new journals established. But of course, there is no previous print spend. So this is one that we're still scratching our heads over. I'm not entirely sure how we'll resolve that, but it's something that we definitely like to look at. And again, we're talking to Sweats about possible different scenarios. Also, something that has come up, that the pricing model currently takes no account of the quality of the journal. There are obviously, in any collection of journals, you have a certain level of variability in terms of the quality. And that's not always reflected in price, as we all know. And there's no relationship between the pricing and the usage, for instance. So these are things that we're looking at, as well as I mentioned earlier, addressing the issues of archival rights and preservation. And a real pain in the neck for all of our publishers is that we have to do holdings checks. So when a potential customer comes along, the publishers have to go back and check what subscriptions they had over the last few years with any of the institutions that that are involved in that contract negotiation. And it's a pain. The publishers don't really like doing it and sweat. I mean, I don't say they don't like doing it. It's just cumbersome for them. And it means that sweats then have to do a lot of chasing to get the information that they need in order to price up the package correctly. And often the tenders are done on quite short timescales, so that can be really challenging. This is an old chestnut. I'm sorry, I don't know why the slides have gone a bit funny here, but journal transfers from one publisher to another, obviously that's, that can be problematic because sometimes the publishers transferring the journals forget that they have an arrangement with us to participate in the collection, and if they've sold that as part of a three-year license deal, for instance, it's not always caught, which can be tricky. Consistent delivery of metadata is an issue as well, particularly for sweats. And when they're out selling it, just moving the collection up the priority list of the consortium, making sure that it's on people's radar. As I mentioned earlier, three-year licenses can be limiting. So in fact, there is some flexibility in how that's addressed. But again, I come back to this point that a consortium of publishers selling to a consortium of libraries amplifies the challenges considerably. But there's no doubt that generally the ALJC has been good. It's met the publishers' objectives. It's met ALPSP's objectives to try and open the market to smaller publishers. And I think, you know, that is evident both by the growth in the number of publishers participating, the number of titles that they have in the collection, and indeed the increase in sales. And I mentioned there, just to close, improvements, which we feel will also lead to further revenue growth. I've mentioned these already, but, you know, pricing model, the standard licensing, for instance, access to the content, and I'm sorry to keep mentioning this, but I can see Toni Tracy in the audience, and she knows this well from her time at Portico, that the archiving solutions has been a headache for us that we hope we can address in the future. Okay, thanks very much.